Chapter 22 Athaclena. A large number of Chims returned to the center, drifting in from the forest where they had been sent to hide. Frederick and Benjamin set them to work dismantling and burning the buildings and their contents. Athaclena and her two assistants hurried from site to site, carefully recording everything before it was put to the torch. It was hard work. Never in her life as a diplomat's daughter had Athaclena felt so exhausted. And yet she dared not let any scrap of evidence go undocumented. It was a matter of duty. About an hour before dusk, a contingent of guerrillas trooped into the encampment, larger, darker, more crouched and feral-looking than their Chim guardians. Under careful direction, they took up simple tasks, helping to demolish the only home they had ever known. The confused creatures watched as their training and testing center and the client's quarters melted into slag. A few even tried to halt the destruction, stepping in front of the smaller, soot-covered Chims and waving vigorous hand signs, trying to tell them that this was a bad thing. Athaclena could see how, by their lights, it wasn't logical. But then, the affairs of patron-class beings often did seem foolish. Finally, the big pre-clients were left standing amid eddies of smoke, with small piles of personal possessions, toys, mementos, and simple tools piled at their feet. They stared blankly at the wreckage, not knowing what to do. By dusk, Athaclena had been nearly worn down by the emotions that fluxed through the compound. She sat on a tree stump, upwind of the burning client's quarters, listening to the great ape's low, chuffing moans. Her aides slumped nearby with their cameras and bags of samples, staring at the destruction, the whites of their eyes reflecting the flickering flames. Athaclena withdrew her corona until all she could ken was the unity glyph, the coalescence to which all the beings within the forest valley contributed. And even that under-image wavered, flickered. She saw it metaphorically, weepy, drooping, like a sad flag of many colors. There was honor here, she admitted reluctantly. These scientists had been violating a treaty, but they couldn't be accused of doing anything truly unnatural. By any real measure, gorillas were as ready for uplift as chimpanzees had been 100 Earth years before contact. Humans had been forced to make compromises back when contact brought them into the domain of galactic society. Officially, the Tenancy Treaty, which sanctioned their rights to their homeworld, was intended to see to it that Earth's fallow species list was maintained, so its stock of potential for sentience would not be used up too quickly. But everyone knew that, in spite of primitive man's legendary penchant for genocide, the Earth was still a shining example of genetic diversity, rare in the range of types and forms that had been left untouched by galactic civilization. Anyway, when a pre-sentient race was ready for uplift, it was ready. No, clearly the treaty had been forced on humans while they were weak. They were allowed to claim neo-dolphins and neo-chimps, species already well on the road to sapiency before contact. But the senior clans weren't about to let Homo sapiens go uplifting more clients than anybody else around. Why, that would have given wolflings the status of senior patrons. Athaclena sighed. It wasn't fair, certainly. But that did not matter. Galactic society depended on oaths kept. A treaty was a solemn vow, species to species. Violations could not go unreported. Athaclena wished her father were here. Uther Kalving would know what to make of the thing she had witnessed here, the well-intended work of this illegal center, and the vile but perhaps legal actions of the Gubru. Utha Kaldheg was far away, though, too far even to touch within the empathy net. All she could tell was that his special rhythm still vibrated faintly on the Nahakieri level. And while it was comforting to close her eyes and inner ears and gently ken it, that faint reminder of him told her little. Nahakieri essences could linger longer after a person left this life, as they had for her dead mother, Mathakluwana. They floated, like the songs of earth whales, at the edges of what might be known by creatures who lived by hands and fire.
"Excuse me, ma'am."
A voice that was hardly more than a raspy growl broke harshly over the faint underglyph, dispersing it. Athaclena shook her head. She opened her eyes to see a neo-chimp with soot-covered fur and shoulders stooped from exhaustion.
"Ma'am, you all right?"
"Yes, I am fine. What is it?"
Anglic felt harsh in her throat, already irritated from smoke and fatigue.
"Directors want to see you, ma'am."
A spendthrift with words, this one. Athaclena slid down from the stump. Her aides groaned, chim theatrically, as they gathered their tapes and samples and followed behind. Several lift lorries stood at the loading dock. Chims and gorillas carried stretchers onto flyers, which then lifted off into the gathering night on softly humming gravitics. Their lights faded away in the direction of Port Helena.
"I thought all the children and elderly were already evacuated. Why are you still loading humans in such a hurry?"
The messenger shrugged. The stresses of the day had robbed many of the chims of much of their accustomed spark. Athaclena was sure that it was only the presence of the gorillas, who had to be set an example, that prevented a mass attack of stress atavism. In so young a client race, it was surprising that chims had done so well. Orderlies hurried to and from the hospital facility, but they seldom bothered the two human directors directly. The neo-chimp scientist, Dr. Schultz, stood in front of them and seemed to be handling most matters himself. At his side, Chim Frederick had been replaced by Athaclena's old traveling companion, Benjamin. On the stage nearby lay a small pile of documents and record cubes, containing the genealogy and genetic record of every gorilla who had ever lived here.
"Ah, respected Timbrimi Athaclena,"
Schultz spoke with hardly a trace of the usual Chim growl. He bowed, then shook her hand in the manner preferred by his people, a full clasp, which emphasized the opposable thumb.
"Please excuse our poor hospitality," he pleaded. "We had intended to serve a special supper from the main kitchen, sort of a grand farewell, but we'll have to make do with canned rations instead, I'm afraid."
A small chimney approached, carrying a platter stacked with an array of containers.
"Dr. Elaine Sue is our nutritionist," Schultz continued. "She tells me you might find these delicacies palatable."
Athaclena stared at the cans.
"Kuthra! Here, 500 parsecs from home, to find an instant pastry made in her own hometown."
Unable to help it, she laughed aloud.
"We have placed a full load of these, plus other supplies, aboard a flitter for you. We recommend you abandon the craft soon after leaving here, of course. It won't be long before the Gubru have their own satellite network in place, and thereafter air traffic will be impractical."
"It won't be dangerous to fly toward Port Helena," Athaclena pointed out. "The Gubru will expect an influx for many days as people seek antidote treatments."
She motioned at the frantic pace of activity.
"So why the near panic I sense here? Why are you evacuating the humans so quickly? Who?"
Looking as if he feared to interrupt her, Schultz nevertheless cleared his throat and shook his head meaningfully. Benjamin gave Athaklana a pleading look.
"Please, sir," Schultz implored with a low voice. "Please speak softly. Most of our chims haven't really guessed."
He let the sentence hang. Athaklana felt a cold thrill along her ruff. For the first time, she looked closely at the two human directors, Taka and Mbazwili. They had remained silent all along, nodding as if understanding and approving everything being said. The black woman, Dr. Taka, smiled at her unblinkingly. Athaklana's corona reached out, then curled back in revulsion. She whirled on Schultz.
"You are killing her."
Schultz nodded miserably.
"Please, sir, softly. You are right, of course. I have drugged my dear friends so they can put up a good front until my few good gym administrators can finish here, get our people away without a panic. It was at their own insistence. Dr. Taka and Dr. Mbazwili felt they were slipping away too quickly from effects of the gas."
He added, sadly, weakly,
"You did not have to obey them. This is murder."
Benjamin looked stricken. Schultz nodded.
"It was not easy. Jim Frederick was unable to bear the shame even this long, and has sought his own peace. I, too, would probably take my life soon, were my death not already as inevitable as my human colleagues."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that the Gubru do not appear to be very good chemists."
The elderly neo-chimp laughed bitterly, finishing with a cough.
"Their gas is killing some of the humans. It acts faster than they said it would. Also, it seems to be affecting a few of us chimps."
Athaklana sucked in her breath.
"I see."
She wished she did not.
"There is another matter we thought you should know about," Schultz said. "A news report from the invaders. Unfortunately, it was in Galactic 3. The Gubru spurn Anglic, and our translation program is primitive. But we know it regarded your father."
Athaklana felt removed, as if she were hovering above it all. In this state, her numbed senses gathered in random details. She could ken the simple forest ecosystem, little native animals creeping back into the valley, wrinkling their noses at the pungent dust, avoiding the area near the center for the fires that still flickered there.
"Yes?"
She nodded a borrowed gesture that all at once felt alien again.
"Tell me."
Schultz cleared his throat.
"Well, it seems your father's star cruiser was sighted leaving the planet. It was chased by warships. The Gubrus say that it did not reach the transfer point. Of course, one cannot trust what they say."
Athaklena's hips rocked slightly out of joint as she swayed from side to side. Tentative mourning, like a trembling of the lips, as a human girl might begin to sense desolation.
"No, I will not contemplate this now. Later, I will decide later what to feel."
"Of course, you may have whatever aid we can offer,"
Jim Schultz continued quietly.
"Your flitter has weapons as well as food. You may fly to where your friend Robert Oneagle has been taken if you wish. We hope, however, that you will choose to remain with the evacuation for a time. At least until the gorillas are safely hidden in the mountains, under the care of some qualified humans who might have escaped."
Schultz looked up at her earnestly, his brown eyes harrowed with sadness.
"I know it is a lot to ask, honored Timbrimi Athaklena. But will you take our children under your care for a time, as they go into exile in the wilderness?"
Chapter 23. exile. The gently humming gravitic craft hovered over an uneven row of dark, rocky ridge spines. Noon-shortened shadows had begun to grow again, as Gimelhai passed its zenith and the flyer settled into the dimness between the stone spines. Its engines grumbled into silence. A messenger awaited its passengers at the agreed rendezvous. The Chim courier handed Athaklena a note as she stepped out of the machine, while Benjamin hurried to spread radar-fouling camouflage over the little flitter. In the letter, Juan Mendoza, a freeholder above Lorne Pass, reported the safe arrival of Robert Oneagle and little April Wu. Robert was recuperating well, the message said. He might be up and about in a week or so. Athaklena felt relieved. She wanted very much to see Robert, and not only because she needed advice on how to handle a ragged band of refugee gorillas and neo-chimpanzees. Some of the Howlett Center Chims, those affected by the Gubrin gas, had gone to the city with the humans, hoping antidote would be given as promised, and that it would work. She had left only a handful of really responsible Chim technicians to assist her. Perhaps more Chims would show up, Athaklena told herself, and maybe even some human officials who had escaped gassing by the Gubru. She hoped that somebody in authority might appear and take over soon. Another message from the Mendoza household was written by a Chim survivor of the battle in space. The militiaman requested help getting in touch with the resistance forces. Athaklena did not know how to reply. In the late hours last night, as great ships descended upon Port Helena and the towns of the archipelago, there had been frantic telephone and radio calls to and from sites all over the planet. There were reports of ground fighting at the spaceport. Some said that it was even hand-to-hand for a time. Then there was silence, and the Gubru armada consolidated without further incident. It seemed that in half a day the resistance so carefully planned by the Planetary Council had fallen completely apart. All traces of a chain of command had dissolved, for nobody had foreseen the use of hostage gas. How could anything be done when nearly every human on the planet was taken so simply out of action? A scattering of Chims were trying to organize here and there, mostly by telephone, but few had thought out any but the most nebulous plans. Athaklena put away the slips of paper and thanked the messenger. Over the hours since the evacuation, she had begun to feel a change within herself. What had yesterday been confusion and grief had evolved into an obstinate sense of determination.
"I will persevere. Uther Kalthing would require it of me, and I will not let him down. Wherever I am, the enemy will not thrive near me."
She would also preserve the evidence she had gathered, of course. Someday the opportunity might come to present it to Timbrimi authorities. It could give her people an opportunity to teach the humans a badly needed lesson on how to behave as a galactic patron race must before it was too late, if it was not too late already. Benjamin joined her at the sloping edge of the ridgetop.
"There," he pointed into the valley below. "There they are, right on time."
Athaklena shaded her eyes. Her corona reached forth and touched the network around her.
"Yes, and now I see them as well."
A long column of figures moved through the forest below, some small ones, brown in color, escorting a more numerous file of larger, darker shapes. Each of the big creatures carried a bulging backpack. A few had dropped to the knuckles of one hand as they shuffled along. Gorilla children ran amidst the adults, waving their arms for balance. The escorting Chims kept alert watch with beam rifles clutched close, Their attention was directed not on the column or the forest, but at the sky. The heavy equipment had already made it by circuitous routes to limestone caves in the mountains, but the exodus would not be safe until all the refugees were there at last in those underground redoubts. Athaclena wondered what was going on now in Port Helena or on the Earth-settled islands. The escape attempt of the Timbrimi courier ship had been mentioned twice more by the invaders, then never again. If nothing else, she would have to find out if her father was still on Garth, and if he still lived. She touched the locket hanging from the thin chain around her neck, the tiny case containing her mother's legacy, a single thread from Mathecluana's corona. It was cold solace, but she did not even have that much from Uthacaldi.
"Oh, father, how could you leave me without even a strand of yours to guide me?"
The column of dark shapes approached rapidly. A low growling, sort of semi-music, rose from the valley as they passed by, like nothing she had ever heard before. Strength these creatures had always owned, and uplift had also removed some of their well-known frailty. And yet their destiny was unclear. But these were, indeed, powerful entities. Athaclena had no intention of remaining inactive, simply a nursemaid for a gang of pre-sentients and hairy clients. One more thing Timbrimi shared with humans was understanding of the need to act when wrong was being done. The letter from the wounded space gem had started her thinking. She turned to her aide.
"I am less than completely fluent in the languages of Earth, Benjamin. I need a word, one that describes an unusual type of military force. I am thinking of any army that moves by night and in the shadow of the land, one that strikes quickly and silently, using surprise to make up for small numbers and poor weapons. I remember reading that such forces were common in the pre-contact history of Earth. They used the conventions of so-called civilized legions when it suited them, and innovation when they liked. It would be a Kchu Nonkron, a wolfling army unlike anything now known. Do you understand what I'm talking about, Benjamin? Is there a word for this thing I have in mind?"
"Do you mean—"
Benjamin looked quickly down at the column of partly uplifted apes, lumbering through the forest below, rumbling their low, strange marching song. He shook his head, obviously trying to restrain himself. But his face reddened, and finally, the guffaws burst out uncontainable. Benjamin hooted and fell against a spine stone, then over onto his back. He rolled in the dust of Garth and kicked at the sky, laughing. Athaclena sighed, first back on Timbrim, then among humans, and now here, with the newest, roughest clients known. Everywhere she found jokers. She watched the chimpanzee patiently, waiting for the silly little thing to catch its breath, and finally let her in on what it found so funny. Part 2. Patriots. Evelyn, a modified dog, viewed the quivering fringe of a special doily draped across the piano with some surprise. In the darkened room where the chairs dismayed and the horrible curtains muffled the rain, she could hardly believe her eyes. A curious breeze, a garlic breath, which sounded like a snore, somewhere near the Steinway, or even from within, had caused the doily fringe to waft and tremble in the gloom. Evelyn, a dog having undergone further modification, pondered the significance of short-person behavior in pedal-depressed, panchromatic resonance and other highly ambient domains. Arf, she said. Frank Zappa. Chapter 24. Fibbin. Tall, gangling, stork-like figures watched the road from atop the roof of a dark, low-slung bunker. Their silhouettes, outlined against the late afternoon sun, were in constant motion, shifting from one spindly leg to another in nervous energy, as if the slightest sound would be enough to set them into flight. Serious creatures, those birds, and dangerous as hell. Not birds, Fibbin reminded himself as he approached the checkpoint. Not in the earthly sense, at least. But the analogy would do. Their bodies were covered with fine down. Sharp, bright yellow beaks jutted from sleek, swept-back faces. And although their ancient wings were now no more than slender, feathered arms, they could fly. Black, glistening, gravitic backpacks more than compensated for what their avian ancestors had long ago lost. Talon soldiers. Fibbin wiped his hands on his shorts, but his palms still felt damp. He kicked a pebble with one bare foot and patted his draft horse on the flank. The placid animal had begun to crop a patch of blue native grass by the side of the road.
"Come on, Tycho," Fibbin said, tugging on the reins. "We can't hang back or they'll get suspicious. Anyway, you know that stuff gives you gas."
Tycho shook his massive gray head and farted loudly.
"I told you so," Fibbin waved at the air.
A cargo wagon floated just behind the horse. The dented, half-rusted bin of the farm truck was filled with rough burlap sacks of grain. Obviously, the anti-grav stator still worked, but the propulsion engine was kaput.
"Come on, let's get on with it."
Fibbin tugged again. Tycho gamely nodded, as if the workhorse actually understood. The traces tightened, and the hover truck bobbed along after them as they approached the checkpoint. Soon, however, a keening sound on the road ahead warned of oncoming traffic. Fibbin hurriedly guided horse and wagon to one side. With a high-pitched whine and a rush of air, an armored hovercraft swept by. Vehicles like it had been cruising eastward intermittently, in ones and twos, all day. He looked carefully to make sure nothing else was coming before leading Tycho back onto the road. Fibbin's shoulders hunched nervously. Tycho snorted at the growing, unfamiliar scent of the invaders.
"Halt!"
Fibbin jumped involuntarily. The amplified voice was mechanical, toneless, and adamant.
"Move! Move to this side! This side for inspection!"
Fibbin's heart pounded. He was glad his role was to act frightened. It wouldn't be hard.
"Hasten! Make haste and present yourself!"
Fibbin led Tycho toward the inspection stand, 10 meters to the right of the highway. He tied the horse's tether to a railed post and hurried around to where a pair of Talon soldiers waited. Fibbin's nostrils flared at the alien's dusty, lavender aroma.
"I wonder what they taste like,"
he thought, somewhat savagely. It would have made no difference at all to his great-to-the-tenth grandfather that these were sentient beings. To his ancestors, a bird was a bird was a bird. He bowed low, hands crossed in front of him, and got his first close look at the invaders. They did not seem all that impressive up close. True, the sharp yellow beak and razor-like talons looked formidable, but the stick-legged creatures were hardly much taller than Fibbin, and their bones looked hollow and thin. No matter, these were starfarers, senior patrons class beings, whose library derived culture and technology, were all but omnipotent long, long before humans rose up out of Africa's savanna, blinking with the dawn light of fearful curiosity. By the time man's lumbering slow ships stumbled upon galactic civilization, the Gubru and their clients had wrested a position of some eminence among the powerful interstellar clans. Fierce conservatism and facile use of the great library had taken them far since their own patrons had found them on the Gubru homeworld and given them the gift of completed minds. Fibbon remembered huge, bellipotent battle cruisers, dark and invincible under their shimmering alacrus shields, with the lambent edge of the galaxy shining behind them. Tycho nickered and shied aside as one of the Talon soldiers, its saber rifle loosely slung, stepped past him to approach the tethered truck. The alien climbed onto the floating farm hover to inspect it. The other guard twittered into a microphone. Half buried in the soft down around the creature's narrow, sharp breastbone, a silvery medallion emitted clipped Anglic words.
State. State identity. Identity and purpose.
Fibbon crouched down and shivered, pantomiming fear. He was not sure many Gubru knew much about Neo-chimps. In the few centuries since contact, little information would have yet passed through the massive bureaucracy of the Library Institute and found its way into local branches. And, of course, the Galactics relied on the library for nearly everything. Still, verisimilitude was important. Fibbon's ancestors had understood one answer to a threat when a counter-bluff was ruled out. Submission. Fibbon knew how to fake it. He crouched lower and moaned. The Gubru whistled in apparent frustration, probably having gone through this before. It chirped again, more slowly this time.
"Do not be alarmed. You are safe,"
the Vodor medallion translated at a lower volume than before.
"You are safe. Safe. We are Gubru, galactic patrons of high clan and family. You are safe. Young half-sentients are safe when they are cooperative. You are safe." Half-sentience.
Fibbon rubbed his nose to cover a sniff of indignation. Of course, that was what the Gubru were bound to think. And, in truth, few 400-year-old client races could be called fully uplifted. Still, Fibbon noted yet another score to settle. He was able to pick out meaning here and there in the invaders' chirpings before the Vodor translated them. But one short course in Galactic 3 back in school was not much to go on, and the Gubru had their own accent and dialect.
"You are safe," the Vodor soothed. "The humans do not deserve such fine clients. You are safe."
Gradually, Fibbon backed away and looked up, still trembling.
"Don't overact,"
he reminded himself. He gave the gangling avian creature an approximation of a correct bow of respect from a bipedal junior client to a senior patron. The alien would surely miss the slight embellishment, an extension of the middle fingers that flavored the gesture.
"Now," the Vodor barked, perhaps with a note of relief, "state name and purposes." "I'm Fibbon. Sir?"
His hands fluttered in front of him. It was a bit of theater, but the Gubru might know that neo-chimpanzees under stress still spoke using parts of the brain originally devoted to hand control. It certainly looked as if the Talon soldier was frustrated, its feathers ruffled, and it hopped a little dance.
"Purpose! Purpose! State your purpose in approaching the urban area."
Bibbin bowed again quickly.
The hover won't work no more. The humans are all gone. Nobody to tell us what to do at the farm.
He scratched his head.
I figured, well, they must need food in town, and maybe somebody can fix the cart and trade for grain.
His voice rose hopefully. The second Gubru returned and chirped briefly to the one in charge. Bibbin could follow its Gal 3 well enough to get the gist. The hover was a real farm tool. It would not take a genius to tell that the rotors just needed to be unfrozen for it to run again. Only a helpless drudge would haul an anti-gravity truck all the way to town behind a beast of burden, unable to make such a simple repair on his own. The first guard kept one taloned, splay-fingered hand over the vodor, but Fibbin gathered their opinion of Chim's had started low and was rapidly dropping. The invaders hadn't even bothered to issue identity cards to the neo-chimpanzee population. For centuries, Earthlings, humans, dolphins, and Chims had known the galaxies were a dangerous place where it was often better to have more cleverness than one was credited for. Even before the invasion, word had gone out among the Chim population of Garth that it might be necessary to put on the old "Yes, Massa" routine.
Yeah, Fibbin reminded himself. But nobody ever counted on all the humans being taken away.
Fibbin felt a knot in his stomach when he imagined the humans, Mels, Femmes, and children, huddled behind barbed wire in crowded camps. Oh, yeah, the invaders would pay. The Talon soldiers consulted a map. The first Gubru uncovered its vodor and twittered again at Fibbin.
You may go, the vodor barked. Proceed to the east side garage complex. You may go. East side garage. Do you know the east side garage?
Fibbin nodded hurriedly.
Yes, sir.
Good. Good creature. Take your grain to the town storage area. Then proceed to the garage. To the garage. Good creature. Do you understand?
Yes.
Fibbin bowed as he backed away, and then scuttled with an exaggeratedly bow-legged gait over to the post, where Tycho's reins were tied. He averted his gaze as he led the animal back onto the dirt embankment beside the road. The soldiers idly watched him pass, chirping contemptuous remarks they were certain he could not understand.
Stupid damned birds, he thought,
while his disguised belt camera panned the fortification. The soldiers, a hover tank that whined by a few minutes later, its crew sprawled upon its flat upper deck, taking in the late afternoon sun. Fibbin waved as they swept by, staring back at him.
I'll bet you'd taste just fine in a nice orange glaze, he thought after the feathered creatures.
Fibbin tugged the horse's reins.
Come on, Tycho, he urged. We gotta make Port Helena by nightfall.
Farms were still operating in the Valley of the Sindh. Traditionally, whenever a starfaring race was licensed to colonize a new world, the continents were left as much as possible in their natural state. On Garth as well, the major Earthling settlements had been established on an archipelago in the shallow western sea. Only those islands had been converted completely to suit Earth-type animals and vegetation. But Garth was a special case. The Burrali had left a mess, and something had to be done quickly to help stabilize the planet's rocky ecosystem. New forms had to be introduced from the outside to prevent a complete biosphere collapse. That meant tampering with the continents. A narrow watershed had been converted in the shadow of the mountains of Mulan. Terran plants and animals that thrived here were allowed to diffuse into the foothills under careful observation, slowly filling some of the ecological niches left empty by the Burrarally Holocaust. It was a delicate experiment in practical planetary ecology, but one considered worthwhile. On Garth and on other catastrophe worlds, the three races of the Terrigans were building reputations as biosphere wizards. Even mankind's worst critics would have to approve of work such as this. And yet, something was jarringly wrong here. Bibbon had passed three abandoned ecological management stations on his way, sampling traps and tracer bots stacked in disarray. It was a sign of how bad the crisis must be. Holding the humans hostage was one thing, a marginally acceptable tactic by modern rules of war, but for the Gubru to be willing to disturb the resurrection of Garth, the uproar in the galaxy must be profound. It didn't bode well for the rebellion. What if the war codes really had broken down? Would the Gubru be willing to use planet busters?
That's the general's problem, Bibbon decided. I'm just a spy. She's the ET expert.
At least the farms were working, after a fashion. Bibbon passed one field cultivated with zygo wheat, and another with carrots. The robo-tillers went their rounds, weeding and irrigating. Here and there he saw a dispirited chim riding a spider-like controller unit, supervising the machinery. Sometimes they waved to him. More often they did not. Once he passed a pair of armed Gubrus standing in a furrowed field beside their landed flitter. As he came closer, Bibbon saw they were scolding a chim farm worker. The avians fluttered and hopped as they gestured at the drooping crop. The foreman nodded unhappily, wiping her palms on her faded dungarees. She glanced at Bibbon as he passed by along the road, but the aliens went on with their rebuke, oblivious. Apparently the Gubru were anxious for the crops to come in. Bibbon hoped it meant they wanted it for their hostages, but maybe they had arrived with thin supplies and needed the food for themselves. In good time when he drew Tycho off the road into a small grove of fruit trees. The animal rested, browsing on the earth-stock grass, while Bibbon sauntered over behind a tree to relieve himself. The orchard had not been sprayed or pest-balanced in some time, he observed. A type of stingless wasp was still swarming over the ping oranges, although the secondary flowering had finished weeks before, and they were no longer needed for pollination. The air was filled with a fruity, almost ripe pungency. The wasps climbed over the thin rinds, seeking access to the sweetness within. Abruptly, without thinking, Bibbon reached out and snatched a few of the insects. It was easy. He hesitated, then popped them into his mouth. They were juicy and crunchy, a lot like termites.
"Just doing my part to keep the pest population down," he rationalized, and his brown hands darted out to grab more.
The taste of the crunching wasps reminded him of how long it had been since he had last eaten.
"I'll need sustenance if I'm to do good work in town tonight," he thought half aloud.
Bibbon looked around. The horse grazed peacefully, and no one else was in sight. He dropped his tool belt and took a step back. Then, favoring his still tender left ankle, he leaped onto the trunk and shimmied up to one of the fruit-heavy limbs.
"Ah," he thought, as he plucked an almost ripe reddish globe.
He ate it like an apple, skin and all. The taste was tart and astringent, unlike the bland human-style food so many chims claim to like these days. He grabbed two more oranges and popped a few leaves into his mouth for good measure. Then he stretched back and closed his eyes.